From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was 30 years ago Sunday that leaders from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints lifted the restriction that had kept black people from full participation in the church. On June 8, 1978, officials announced that God had revealed a change in a Mormon practice that had persisted for decades, even during the most tumultuous times of the civil rights movement. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary that traces the complicated history of this story. It explores the surprising legacy of black people in Mormonism, how they reconcile their racial and cultural identity with their faith. There are myths and misperceptions that persist, the film points it out, and we'll ask why. And we'll talk about the challenges ahead for black Mormons. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For many members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the announcement that the restriction on black people receiving the Mormon priesthood had been lifted put an end to the matter. Most were glad to see it go. It was, after all, an extremely controversial policy that somehow had persisted within the church, even during the most tumultuous times of the civil rights movement. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the announcement that Mormons believe was a revelation from God making that change. But not everyone has put the issue aside. And the fact is, not everyone really understands the complicated history of this era in Mormonism. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary that tells the story. It's part history. It explores the legacy of black people in the Mormon story. And it could be said it's part testimony. It's about how black Mormons reconcile their racial and cultural identity with their faith. There are myths and misperceptions that persist. And today in the program, we're going to talk about why, talk about the challenges ahead for Mormons. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Darius Gray. He worked for KSL Radio and Television in the 60s and 70s. From 1997 to 2003, he served as president of the Genesis Group. It's an organization for black Latter-day Saints. His most recent project is the documentary we're going to be talking about today. It's called Nobody Knows, The Untold History of Black Mormons, and it's due out, as we understand it, in August. And Darius, again, welcome.
Thank you.
We should also say that Margaret Blair Young is with us. She teaches creative writing at Brigham Young University. She's a co-producer for the documentary. She and Gray have also co-authored an historical fiction trilogy called Standing on the Promises about blacks in the early LDS Church. And Professor Young, welcome to you.
Thanks.
D. Michael Quinn is going to be with us today. He's an independent historian whose work focuses on the LDS Church. He's published a number of articles and books, including two on Mormon hierarchy. Quinn is joining us today by phone from his home in Claremont, California. And Michael Quinn, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Let me begin, first of all, if I could, by asking you about the title of the of the documentary itself. Nobody Knows. The untold story. The untold thing was the thing that I think was interesting. What does that mean, Margaret Young, that there's really not a concept within Mormonism of the history here?
Oh, not just within Mormonism, but
of course, yeah.
Outside of Mormonism. When Darius and I have done book signings, for example, outside of Utah, and they see that we're writing about black Mormon pioneers, the immediate, we can predict the response, and we usually give it about two sentences. You mean there were some? I thought you didn't let blacks into the Mormon church until, what was it, 1980? Or I thought you didn't let blacks join at all. You have Michael Quinn, who actually does know the story, but he's an exception. Generally, we find within Mormonism and outside of Mormonism, there is no concept at all of the fact that there is a legacy of black pioneers and a legacy of black priesthood holders.
What is it, as a white woman, I'm interested, what is it that interested you in this subject in particular? It's not to say that white people can't, of course, be interested in the subject, but do you take a particular interest? What is it?
I was raised in a in a very multicultural world. My father's a linguist and traveled a lot. I have spent a lot of time in Central and South America. And so I was raised with various complexions in my home. But I actually started writing our books before I met Darius. And in fact, Doug, I ordered a program from KUR that I believe you had something to do with, and Michael Quinn was a part of it. I think it was called A Like Unto God.
Yeah.
And I had the
exactly 10 years ago.
1998.
Yeah.
I had that cassette tape in my purse on July 29th, 1998. Eugene England and I were doing a presentation at Sunstone about where are we 20 years after the priesthood revelation, and Darius Gray had gotten tickets and decided that he wanted to see what two white people knew about this and showed up, and he introduced himself, and I pulled the cassette tape out of my hand and said, I've got you on this tape. And that was I had written about 100 pages. That's, you know, I had published a few books and just really wanted to do something that wouldn't just win awards but would make a difference.
Yeah.
And when I showed Darius what I had written, he said, I can help with this. This is the language of my childhood. And that began a partnership which has now gone into documentary in addition to the fiction, historical fiction.
Before we jump into the history part, I want to ask you both this. Darius, actually, let me direct this to you. This is a razor-thin line you're having to walk, it seems, in some ways, to try to explain the faith of Black Mormons and their experience and not apologize for the past. Is this a difficult thing? Do you see it as a sort of delicate balance that you're trying to walk here?
I have no desire to apologize. I'm not in a position to apologize. It's not my role. But to identify the history and to speak to it, I think that is something that we all can do and should do. So it's not about apologizing. Has it been difficult being a Black Latter-day Saint at times? Yes, very difficult. Is it difficult right now? Yes. But yet I remain, and I'm happy to be a Latter-day Saint, and very happy to be Black.
An important part of the story, of course, is the history of African Americans in the early days of Mormonism. That they played a role at all, Darius Gray, may be surprising to many people. Do you find – we talked about that it is a surprise, but I want you to introduce us to a character because there are a number of really good characters in the documentary, Eliza Abel.
Oh, I truly admire that man and look forward to meeting him. Brother Abel – well, first of all, the LDS Church was officially started in 1830. 2 years later, we have Brother Abel, 1832, being baptized as a Latter-day Saint, a man of color, biracial, but identified easily by the census takers as either Black or mulatto. And from that point forward, we have had a Black presence in the LDS Church. So he was somewhat our beginning. In 1836, Brother Abel was ordained to the LDS priesthood, something that was little known for many years and has been disputed by some. But later that same year, I believe it was in December of 1836, he was made a member of the Third Quorum of the 70 in the LDS Church. Brother Abel went on to serve three full-time missions for the faith and came home early from that third mission and died in December of 1884, if I remember correctly. So here is a man who has had an effect on the church, and more so, I think, in the early days when his presence was better known. But hopefully that presence will become better known, and I hope the documentary and the novels that we've done are a part of that. He was a carpenter, a mortician. He worked on the Kirtland Temple, the Nauvoo Temple, and the Salt Lake Temple. And I've been privileged to visit all three, and I have a little ritual. There's a spot, a corner on each temple that I go to, and I rub it. And I say, that's for you, Brother Abel. and I've shown the younger Black members of the church that have been down at Temple Square with me at times that same spot and ask them to do the same when I'm gone, to remember Brother Elijah Abel.
Michael Quinn, Eliza Abel, Josiah. Elijah. Forgive me, Abel. Michael Quinn, how important is Elijah Abel as a precedent here? I guess the point is, of course, that it's evidence that Joseph Smith did, in fact, ordain at least one black man to the Mormon priesthood.
Well, I think the extraordinarily important part of Elijah Abel's experience in Mormonism is that this was not an ordination that occurred out in the hinterland of the church. He was a resident of church headquarters at that time in Kirtland, Ohio, and he was ordained initially first to the office of elder and then about 6 months later to the office of 70 with the complete authorization of the president of the church. And that cannot be overstated as an important departure, because the idea of ordination to priesthood in Mormonism meant that you were an individual who was participating in ordinances of God as an agent of God. And for this to be given to an African-American in the 1830s, when the general consensus of white society was that African-Americans were inherently inferior, that just can't be overstated in its importance for understanding Joseph Smith's attitudes toward humanity and the eternal possibilities of all people, including those of black African ancestry.
How much evidence do we have of these sort of progressive, certainly progressive for the time, views of Joseph Smith? How did he regard black people in the scheme of things? Margaret Young?
Well, we have Joseph Smith echoing the sentiment of the day early on with blacks as the seed of Cain, and that was the common thought in much of the world, used ultimately seed of Cain, to justify slavery. But you see Joseph Smith kind of become radical in his views in 1844, the year he was killed. He was also running for president, and in his political campaign, he called for the emancipation of blacks and said, break off the shackles from the poor black man and hire him out to labor for an hour of bondage is worth, or an hour of liberty is worth an eternity of bondage. He also, besides probably ordaining Elijah Abel, we have at least one source that suggests that he himself did the ordination. We know he knew of it because his father, Joseph Smith Sr., gave Elijah Abel a patriarchal blessing that we have record of and says clearly, thou hast been ordained an elder. But also Jane Elizabeth Manning James, who with her siblings traveled from Buffalo, New York, walked on foot from Buffalo, New York to Nauvoo, were welcomed into Joseph Smith's household, and Joseph invited Jane to be adopted to the Smith family as a child, not as a servant, but as a child. And that suggests some rather radical thinking, given the fact that you've got the Nat Turner Rebellion back in, 1831, and in Illinois, you've had Elijah Lovejoy, a publisher of an abolitionist paper, killed. You've got racial tension all over the place. Mm-hmm. We're going to have the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850. So with the racial tension, for him to take the stance that he did is really quite remarkable.
Michael Quinn, how unique was it in the sort of in the scheme of things in terms of where other Christian religions, Protestant religions were in, on the American frontier and in America in general?
Well, that varied. In many ways, the statement of Martin Luther King more than a century later was certainly true of this era, is that the worship hour on Sunday was the most segregated day in America. And that was true for the churches north and south, that for the most part, churches segregated the attendance of African Americans in the worship space. There were exceptions, but for the most part, that was the case. In Mormonism, that would not have really been possible because there were so few African-American members of the LDS Church. And that was true for really the entire 19th century history of Mormonism. And so there wouldn't have been a convenient physical space to which African-American members of the LDS Church could have been confined in the physical worship spaces of the time period. So to that extent, there was no physical separation, segregation that was possible either in residence or in the worship hour. And had it been a situation similar to the Methodists, similar to other groups, particularly in Utah, I think there would have been a physical separation because of Brigham Young's very strident views about the inferiority of anyone with Black African ancestry. But there really wasn't much of a comparison because the other churches, Catholic and Protestant, had large numbers of Blacks, and typically the response during the worship hour was segregation, which led to the formation of Black churches.
There's another great character that you've folded into this story, and that's of Jane Manning. Margaret Young, tell a little bit about her story, because her plea that she makes to leaders is as poignant as it gets, and it's recorded, and we'll play an excerpt here in just a moment.
Well, why don't we just go directly to that plea? Jane, who had walked 800 miles, as she puts in her life story, with her mother and siblings from Buffalo. She was actually from Wilton, Connecticut, took a canal boat to Buffalo, New York, and then walked on foot 800 miles. To Nauvoo, Illinois, and had a beautiful relationship with Joseph and Emma Smith. In fact, she says that Lucy Mack Smith let her handle without seeing the Urim and Thummim. So she felt that she had been given some special status. And then she came west with the pioneers, was in one of the They arrived in September. You have the first group.
The second company, I believe.
Okay, yeah. You have the first group arriving in July. She arrived in September. And the thing that I found significant is that as we were putting all of our characters together and looking at the dates, you have the death of Elijah Abel on Christmas Day, 1884, 2 weeks after his return from his third mission. And that very day, Jane James walks to John Taylor's house. They have some kind of conversation that she alludes to on December 27th in a letter. Jane could read but couldn't write, so the letter was written by Elizabeth J.D. Roundy. But the letter was written on the day of Elijah's funeral and says, "Dear brother, I called on your house last Thursday, the day Elijah Abel died, to have some conversation with you concerning my future salvation." And says, "I realize my race and color and cannot expect my endowments as others who are white. Yet this is the fullness of times, and through Abraham all mankind may be blessed. Is there no blessing for me?"
Well, that's the quote. So you have this memorized, don't you?
I do. Jane, I feel very close to Jane. I have tremendous love and admiration for her. That one of the things that Darius and I have done with others and with contributions from others is erect a monument to Jane Manning James that depicts her giving a gift of flour to a white pioneer, Eliza Partridge Lyman. We know about that from Eliza's journal. And to me, that has always been emblematic of Joseph in the Old Testament delivering his brothers with his gift of when he was in a position to do so, though they had sold him into slavery, giving them the way to survive through the grain.
Darius Gray, how poignant is that that letter for you? It's a very powerful expression.
It's a powerful expression from a powerful woman. Again, going back to the statements made by Michael, and by the way, hello, Michael.
Hi.
But going back to reflect on the times, what was occurring in this nation during those days for Jane Elizabeth Manning James to be the strong woman that she was and to exercise her voice not to be shy and demure and in the background, but to ask for that which she felt she deserved in terms of temple blessings, to be proactive in that day as a black woman, or as any woman, but in particular a black woman, I think speaks greatly to her strength.
As we go into a break, we're going to hear again that clip from Jane Manning James. We invite you to join us, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Michael Quinn is with us, an independent historian based in California. Darius Gray is with us, and Margaret Blair Young, co-producers of a new documentary, Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio.
Dear brother, I called on your house last Thursday to have conversation with you concerning my future salvation. I realize my race and color and cannot expect my endowments as others who are white. Yet God promised Abraham that in his seed all nations of the earth should be blessed. Is there no blessings for me? Your sister in the gospel, Jane E. James.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sunday marked the 30th anniversary of the decision by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to rescind their color ban and grant black people full participation in the church. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary that traces the complicated history of the story, explores the surprising legacy of black people and Mormonism. We're also talking about the myths and misperceptions that many say persist, talking about the challenges ahead for black Mormons. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We are here with Michael Quinn, an independent historian based in California. Darius Gray and Margaret Blair Young are co-producers of the documentary, which, by the way, is called Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons. You can join us again at 801-585-WEST or our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, of course, the question comes, why did things change? How was it that Elijah Abel was able to hold the priesthood, hold positions of standing within Mormon leadership? And how did we get around to where we are now? And I'm wondering, how did the restriction come to be a part of Mormonism when it wasn't a part of the earliest part of the Mormon Church? And it seems to be that we're led to Brigham Young. Michael Quinn, is this where the story starts to get complicated? Is it Brigham Young that begins to change things?
Actually, with Brigham Young, it's uncomplicated. Brigham Young was a thoroughgoing racist in terms of how we would define attitudes today. At his time, he was simply a typical a white American who viewed African Americans and all people of black African ancestry, as did European, British, and American scientists, thinkers of the time. What was complicated was Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith, I would like to present as the ultimate racist departure. But he had mixed views. One thing that he and Brigham Young shared in common was a opposition to intermarriage between African Americans and people of other non-black groups, whether they were Caucasian or Indian or whatever their background. In that, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were united. But about the potential of African Americans for economic, social, and religious growth, that's where Brigham Young and Joseph Smith split. And I think the greatest manifestation of that wasn't simply the ordination of one black man at church headquarters, Elijah Abel, in 1836. It was Joseph Smith's statement publicly in a sermon in 1843, where he talked about the situation of African Americans, and he said that the only thing that separated a black man between the elite of Washington, D.C., was opportunity. And that was a radical, revolutionary kind of statement, because in the minds of Brigham Young, as well as all of the published statements, the people of African-American, black African-American descent were inherently inferior. And Joseph Smith rejected that. And he stated publicly that the only thing that separated the poorest and least accomplished African-American in Philadelphia, which was his place of comparison, from the elite of Washington, D.C., the only thing that separated them was opportunity. And that indicated that he did not accept the conventional view of black inferiority, and that if given the opportunity, and he certainly gave it to Elijah Abel, that African-Americans or black Africans in Africa could achieve anything that a white person could achieve. That was radical. Hmm. But at the same time, he was opposed to the intermarriage of whites and blacks, and he had conflicting views about slavery. He really denied that he was an abolitionist. He didn't like that term because he, Joseph Smith, regarded that as a radical position. And his argument for freeing African Americans from slavery in 1844, his published argument, was not as an abolitionist, but as a more conservative position, that he wanted there to be compensated freedom so that those who own African Americans as slaves would be compensated for their freedom. So he tried to take a middle road on slavery. He was as racist on intermarriage as any white American of that time. But in terms of the more fundamental issue of potential, of the question of inferiority or equality, Joseph Smith had a radical position that almost was unique in American society at that time.
And Doug, if I may, I think it's important to note that when we speak of an Elijah Abel, he was not a solo act. He was not the only black man to have been ordained to the LDS priesthood.
No, that's true, but he was the only one at church headquarters that had that direct knowledge of Joseph Smith, and possibly also Joseph Smith ordaining him. But no, there Q. Walker Lewis in Massachusetts was also ordained.
And Pete McCary.
And he was ordained by Joseph Smith's brother.
Right. And so there was a change that came about, and it wasn't just because of one black man, but we know of at least three black men. Margaret?
The fact that Michael just said Q. Walker Lewis indicates that he's familiar, as I think I already knew, with Connell O'Donovan's research on Walker Lewis. Remarkable man. We're actually going to be interviewing Connell. We're going to the San Francisco Black Film Festival on Thursday. We'll show our film on Saturday and interview Connell after that. But the significance of Walker Lewis is that we have a statement from Brigham Young referring to Walker in 1847, saying we have one of the best elders, an African, in Lowell, Massachusetts. That's Walker Lewis. So in 1847, Brigham Young is not suggesting that there's any kind of priesthood restriction.
So we've established that there were black men who got the priesthood in the early days of Mormonism. Explain, what is it? What did people find, Brigham Young and others, what did they find in Mormon doctrine, in scriptures, that led them to, you know, justify keeping black people out of from full fellowship within Mormonism? How did that work?
I think you're going to find a multiplicity of answers there. I don't think there's a single answer. And we might all lend ourselves to one particular approach or another. Joseph was dead. The moderating force had been killed in 1844. And now it was a new pharaoh, if you would, in Egypt. and the new pharaoh was less accommodating to persons of color. However, one of the things that I've noted in the shift, when the Latter-day Saints left the East, left, Ohio, and then went into Missouri, and from Missouri into Illinois, and then left Illinois and came west, they had really shot their financial wad. They were poor. And they got here, and many people are aware of the story of the crickets and the seagulls and how the first crop was endangered because of the crickets trying to overtake the crops. One of the things that helped to save that budding, fledgling group here in Utah was the saints from the South, the Mississippi saints, they're often called, who had been taught while in the South and now were joining the body of the saints in the West. And they had not been to Ohio. They had not been to Missouri or to Illinois. They had not spent their money. They still had their wealth intact, and part of that wealth was their slaves. And so when we had the Southern saints come into Utah, into the territory, I remember as Margaret and I were doing research for the trilogy, there was a book that we found where Brigham Young said, we need to accommodate the Southern saints. And I think part of what occurred was that accommodation. When Brigham in 1852 spoke before the territorial legislature suggesting that this territory be a slave territory. A lot of people don't know that Utah was not free. It was a slave territory. And I think that influence of the Southern saints and the need of the body of saints who were here and somewhat destitute were elements in that change of policy.
Somebody help me out here. There's an important question in the film, important question in this issue in general, which is, was the restriction against blacks a policy, which implies that it was the idea of men who were giving in to the prejudices of the day? Or was it a doctrine, which implies something completely different, that in fact it was God who had imposed the restriction? What do you want to say about that?
Oh, well, I would say we have two presidents of the church who have said that it was policy, and then I believe we have some who have said that it was doctrine. Heber J. Grant said it was a policy. David O. McKay said it was a policy. And so that's been part of the problem. What is it? Who said it? But if you're looking for doctrine, you need to drop back to some doctrinal source. Where is it in the scriptures? Where is that revelation that would have made it doctrine? And no such scripture or revelation has been found or put forward.
So
I think that one of the crucial issues on that is what Brigham Young said in 1852 when he asked the Utah legislature to legalize slavery for African Americans. And as he was giving the justification for it, and his justification was restating the racist views of the vast majority of Americans and British and Europeans at that time about the inferiority of people of black African ancestry, and linked with that the religious view that they were descendants of Cain. But the crucial issue comes to one phrase he made during that, where he talked about extending it to priesthood. And he said, if no other prophet before me has ever said this, this is what I say. And it's very clear that Brigham Young did not appeal to, certainly to Joseph Smith or to any other religious precedent for denying priesthood to African Americans, as he was explaining it publicly in 1852. He just said, if no one else has ever said it before, I'm saying it now. And so this is something where he recognized he was departing from Joseph Smith, and in his own view, he was departing from all of faithful, religious, true revelation that had been given by God to prophets during all the dispensations of Mormon history and the history since of God's dealings since Adam. He was not a shy person, And he just took that responsibility on himself, and I think that's where we have to leave it.
And let me add that after Brigham Young's death, he died in 1877, there's a very important meeting in 1879. Elijah Abel, after Brigham's death, he had been washed and anointed, received the initiatory ordinances of the temple and the Kirtland Temple. But when he arrived in Salt Lake City in the early 1850s, he was not permitted the endowment. He asked for it several times and was not allowed. But in 1879, with Brigham Young dead, he asked again. He wanted to be sealed to his wife, who at the time was dying. She died very soon afterwards. And a meeting was held, and the question wasn't, now, what did Brigham Young say about it? It was, what did Joseph Smith say about it? And basically, you had two men called in, Zebedee Coltrane and Abraham Smoot. And Zebedee Coltrane claimed that he knew what Joseph Smith had said about it, and said that Joseph had said that, no, the Lord hath said, the Negro hath no right to the priesthood. And Abraham Smoot said, well, in the South, we were told to never ordain a slave. But do you separate slaves from all blacks? Zebedee Coltrane said that Elijah Abel had been dropped from the quorum as soon as his race was discovered. And then Joseph F. Smith, who was also a prominent church leader, corrected that, and corrected it not only verbally but with certificates, saying that's not true. There are certificates in 1841. There's a certificate after Elijah Abel arrived in Utah verifying his status as a 70.
So let me ask you this then. I understand this is a complicated issue with a complicated history, complicated mix of, you know, American culture, religious culture. Can leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints today make a definitive statement, will they, that this was in fact not God's will, that it was just wrong, that it was a mistake made by imperfect men, or maybe the less charitable description could be by men who were giving in to prejudice. Will you ever hear that? That this was because that seems to be a sticking point.
Well, you know, that's a question that I'm sure you would love to ask the president of the church.
Sure.
And, he is the only one who actually could officially speak to that. Do I think it's a possibility? I would hope that it's a possibility. And I base that on my religious faith. God is no respecter of persons. If you look at the history of this question, the evidence is there and it's clear. And I believe that ultimately, as we have been moving toward a greater understanding and a greater openness and a greater willingness to speak to difficult issues, that ultimately the church will speak to that. They've not done so at this point, but I have faith in God, not in man, but in God, that it can come about.
I guess the question that we'll get to after a break, because we're late on the break, is what's the holdup? And we'll get to that in a moment. Michael Quinn is with us, an independent historian in California. Darius Gray and Margaret Blair Young also here, co-producers of a new documentary, Nobody Knows the Untold Story of Black Mormons, which is due out in August. We're going to take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In June of 1978, leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints say they received a revelation which granted all men in the church the priesthood, regardless of their race. Today in the program, we're talking with the creators of a new documentary, Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons, talking about the history that led up to that change, asking how black members see their position in the church these three decades later. Michael Quinn is also with us, an independent historian. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Someone say, if they would, what happened in 1969. Michael Quinn, you want to take that in just a couple of minutes? Because I think a lot of people don't realize how close the Mormon Church came in 1969, not 78, to actually making a change. Say something about that, if you would.
Well, the situation was complicated, as this whole history is. One of the complications was that the LDS Church was under tremendous pressure, and Mormons individually, from the as a result of the civil rights movement in the United States, that both many institutions as well as large numbers of individuals were critical of the LDS Church's exclusion of African Americans from priesthood. Combined with that, you had the physical incapacity of the president of the church, David O. McKay, who had, although he tended to say to people what they wanted to hear on this issue, and so to people who were liberal like Sterling McMurrin, he made pro-civil rights kinds of statements, and to people who believed in segregation, he made segregationist statements. That kind of duality was not available in 1969 because he was so physically incapacitated. And as a result, the counselor, who was his first counselor, Hugh B. Brown, had an enormous amount of influence in 1969. And he was a liberal, a political and social liberal, who had been on record for a long time, both publicly and privately, as opposed to the exclusion of African Americans and all blacks from priesthood, and hoping that that would one day change. Well, in 1969, he prepared to make that kind of change. And he came very close to succeeding. But because there were members of the Quorum of the Twelve who were opposed to it, that change did not occur, and David O. McKay died in January 1970, and that ended any administrative power that Hugh B. Brown had. He was immediately released by the death of the president from being the counselor, and the new president, Joseph Fielding Smith, with Harold B. Lee as first counselor. The two of them were united in support of the policy of exclusion of blacks. And so that moment passed. But because of the combination of the national situation, the incapacitation of President McKay, and the ascendance of Hugh B. Brown, there was that potential. And Hugh B. Brown thought he could actually make the change, but he was unable to.
801-585 West is the number to join the conversation. We have a number of people who want to join the conversation, a few emails. I want to mention that we're going to do two parts of this show. We didn't actually intend that when we first started, but there's a lot of information to get through. We want to sort of lay the groundwork historically here, and then we're going to be in the coming days, possibly next week, getting to part two of the conversation, which sort of leads us to sort of the modern, predicament of blacks within Mormonism, how they see their lives. We don't want to give that short shrift, so those of you who have questions about that, we apologize. We'll get to that in part two. Let's take a call, though. Don is with us in Salt Lake. Don, welcome.
Hi. I think the comment that I have dovetails into your question of, you know, what's the holdup. And I have two parts to my comment, and I'll try to be brief. The first comment is, this whole thing sort of reminds me of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. He's writing to the religious community while he's sitting in jail saying, how long are we supposed to wait? I mean, your guests are talking as though, okay, eventually God will fix this problem. But in anything that has to do with social change, the devout can say it was God, but sociologists will say, well, it was just the passing of time, the changing of attitudes. You know, and you don't know, will the courts change the attitude? Did society change the attitudes? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really sure that we should put it on God to say, okay, well, we'll wait for God to make these changes in our hearts. You know, it just doesn't, it seems like a cheap way out. Me, we defer that responsibility. The other thing to me is, I listen to who is not calling. I mean, I've tuned in and out of this program for the last hour. Like every 10 minutes, I'll tune in, and it's always the guests talking. I don't really hear a lot of people. And your producer said only a few people have called in. This is such a huge subject, considering that we're on the verge of possibly electing a black president. And it seems to me that the fact that, I mean, who is not, are black Mormons not calling in? Are devout white Mormons not calling in? I mean, if this is such an important subject, even if you are splitting it into two parts, I would think that the phone lines would be flooded right now. Mm. And the fact that there haven't been a whole lot of calls just makes me think this is either a subject that people have already made up their minds about and they don't want to talk about, or it's a subject that makes them so uncomfortable they don't want to talk about it. But it just, it's just pitiful to me. It just seems pitiful to me. And that's my comment.
Glad you called, Don. Thanks very much. Let me mention also, we have a discussion board online at KUER.org. You can maybe get the ball rolling there as well, continue some of our comments. And we're anticipating that the next program is going to be a little bit more caller-driven, we think. But Don's right. We haven't gotten a lot of calls, and that does make you wonder. I should also mention that we also spoke earlier today. We don't have time for the conversation today. We'll fold that into the second part. Darren Smith, a black member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, teaches sociology at Utah Valley State College. He's written on the black experience in the church and talks about his perceptions. We'll get to that next week. 801-585 West, though, is that number to join us. KUER.org, if you want to join the discussion board, join the conversation there at the discussion board. I want to ask about Darius. Yeah, you want to react?
Yeah, I'd like to react to that, and I thank Don for his call. But I think maybe he misunderstood what I was saying when I indicated that I have faith in God. Many of us, hundreds of us, thousands of us, have not just been sitting on our thumbs. Margaret Young and I have been partnered for 10 years, busting our butts, frankly, writing three novels, telling the stories as honestly as we could find the information and present it of these black pioneers. All of that is, in our estimation, changing the playing field, the knowledge base out there. The documentary, which Don likely has not seen, is not a Mormon proselytizing piece, and it's also not a Mormon bashing piece. Again, we've tried to produce or present information as honestly and openly as possible. We, as well as thousands of others, are adding to the body of knowledge. We are talking about this subject and trying to bring about change. However, we do not control the leadership of the LDS Church. God does, in my opinion. Thank you very much. And so, yes, I'm hoping that God speaks to their hearts and to their souls. But for the rest of us, we're doing all that we can do, and we're not just sitting idly by.
I want to play a clip from an episode of a television program produced by KBYU Television. It's the Pearl of Great Price series. It's apparently a conversation that they have about Mormon scripture. Pearl of Great Price is a Mormon scripture. It features a number of Brigham Young University scholars, and they have these conversations about Mormon scripture. This particular episode, which as I understand is going to air next week, next Sunday on KBYU, talks about the priesthood restriction through the ages. We got word of this from a blog. And it gives some sense of the fact that these perceptions tend to persist within Mormonism. Let me play a clip here. And I'm not sure who is speaking. This particular series features Robert Millett, Camille Franck, Andrew Skinner, Michael Rhodes, Richard Draper, and Dale LeBaron. I'm not sure who is actually speaking during this small clip, but I want to play it and have you respond to it, if you would. Go ahead.
The prophet Joseph Smith begins, so far as we can tell, sometime in 1836, 37, somewhere in the late 1830s, he begins a policy of restriction concerning the priesthood. Mm-hmm. What do we know about this? What do we not know about this?
Well, I would think at least part of the stimulus to thinking along those lines must have come from the translation of the Book of Abraham.
That's what I would think.
And of course, it's got to tie back into the Book of Moses as well, because it's in the Book of Moses where it specifically addresses the skin color as an aspect of it.
Yes.
You know, this is another very touchy part of this whole hard doctrine, is the black skin associated with that lineage which is denied the priesthood.
Robert Millet there I identify. Maybe we should have had on the program, but we just got word about this recently. What does that say to you? That you're still hearing these things persist. It's something that's going to air next Sunday, this idea that, what? This idea still persists within Mormonism.
It's astonishing that religion professors at Brigham Young University begin with the false premise that in 1836, Joseph Smith is restricting priesthood to people of African American ancestry or a black African ancestry, when in fact it was the opposite.
Exactly.
In 1836, Joseph Smith was expanding priesthood to persons of black African ancestry, and he did so with full knowledge of the content of the Book of Moses and with full knowledge of those scriptures and passages in the Book of Abraham that he himself was in the process of translating. And despite those statements about a lineage that does not have right of priesthood, Joseph Smith did not see that as a universal restriction on priesthood.
We have about 2 minutes left, so I want to get some final words on this. Darius and Margaret, say something about this, if you would, because we're about out of time.
Well, the good news is I know the blog that that's on, and what I've seen is that young people are resisting this very strongly. And what's wonderful to read is in their responses, they do know the material. And they're stating very, very solidly that we have no evidence that Joseph Smith ever instituted the ban. For me to see the young people responding says we are in a new age of information. You can't get away with saying the kinds of things that you could have said even a decade ago.
It saddens me. I know two of those individuals fairly well, and I think very highly of them. But their lack of scholarship in this case offends me, and it saddens me greatly because of the harm that it can do.
We'll see if we can get a reaction from them as we go along. Again, this is just the beginning of the story. We'll get to the second part of this. There's a lot more to talk about. It's about race. It's about culture, new ideas, old ideas. So we'll get you back to talk about it. Michael Quinn, an independent historian, joined us from his home in Claremont, California. Michael Quinn, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the privilege.
Darius Gray, Margaret Blair Young, co-producers of the new documentary, which is coming out in August, by the way. It's called Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
There's a link, by the way, to their website and other resources at KUER.org. And you can jump on the discussion board and tell us what you think. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson and produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.